A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
We've got a special guest prompt today from Alfonso Hemmingbottom, a music producer in Tel Aviv. He just picked up a new office rental in a managed commercial building there. Beautiful space, loves everything about it except for one thing he didn't catch during the viewing. The building pumps an artificial fragrance through every space, including his private office, and he cannot stand it. He's signed on for a year, he's got high sensory sensitivity, and he's asking, will he get used to this naturally? Can you desensitize yourself to a scent, or is he just stuck with it? Alfonso, thank you for sending this in. I feel like we should acknowledge up front, this is the kind of problem that sounds small, until you're the one living inside a scented candle you didn't light.
It's a fantastic question, and honestly, it cuts right to the heart of how our sensory systems actually work versus how we assume they work. The short answer is, yes, you will adapt, but it's more complicated than just getting used to it, and the mechanism that does the work is fascinating.
All right, unpack that. What's the mechanism?
The phenomenon is called olfactory habituation. It's not just a psychological trick where you decide to stop caring about a smell, it's a genuine neurobiological process. Your olfactory receptor neurons, the ones in your nasal epithelium that detect odor molecules, they physically stop firing at the same rate when they're exposed to a constant stimulus. This happens at the receptor level, not in your brain's interpretation layer. The neurons themselves reduce their signaling.
It's not mind over matter, it's nose over mind.
Well, not exactly, but yes, it's peripheral adaptation. And this kicks in remarkably fast. Within about 15 to 20 minutes of continuous exposure to a constant odor, your sensitivity to that specific odor drops dramatically. There was a classic study by Dalton back in the 90s that quantified this. Participants exposed to a constant odorant showed a 60 to 70% reduction in perceived intensity within the first half hour.
Of course, that's the controlled lab version. Alfonso's walking into this building every morning. Fresh start each day. Does the habituation reset overnight?
That's the critical piece. Olfactory habituation is context-dependent and exposure-dependent. If you leave the scented environment for several hours, like going home for the evening and sleeping, a significant portion of the adaptation reverses. Not all of it, but a lot. So every morning when Alfonso walks back in, he's going to get hit with that fragrance again. The question is whether the long-term adaptation builds up over weeks and months, and the answer is yes, but it's uneven. There are two layers to this. The first is the peripheral adaptation we talked about, the receptors dialing down. That's fast and resets relatively quickly. The second is central habituation, which happens in the brain's olfactory processing centers, the piriform cortex, the orbitofrontal cortex. Over repeated exposures across days and weeks, your brain starts to classify the odor as non-threatening background noise. It becomes less salient. You stop consciously noticing it as often.
This sounds like the olfactory equivalent of living next to train tracks. The first week you think you've made a terrible mistake. By month three, you sleep through the freight train.
That's a really good parallel. And the time course is similar. Most people report significant reduction in annoyance within 2 to 4 weeks of daily exposure. But here's where Alfonso's high sensory sensitivity comes in, and this is genuinely important. Not everyone habituates at the same rate.
He mentioned he's got sensitivity comparable to Daniel's, and we've talked about Daniel's interoceptive awareness before. He notices signals most people filter out. I'd imagine that extends to exteroception too. External sensory input.
There's a body of research on what's sometimes called sensory processing sensitivity. Roughly 15 to 20% of the population falls into the highly sensitive range. For these individuals, habituation to sensory stimuli is often slower and less complete. It's not that they can't adapt, they can, but the baseline reactivity is higher and the rate of adaptation is lower. So Alfonso might be looking at more like 6 to 8 weeks before it really fades into the background, and even then, it might still break through into conscious awareness more frequently than it would for someone with average sensitivity.
That's a meaningful difference. A month versus 2 months of walking into a fragrance you hate every morning. And we haven't even touched on the emotional component yet. He didn't just say he notices it. He said he can't stand it.
That matters enormously. Odor perception is uniquely tied to emotion in a way that other senses aren't. The olfactory bulb projects directly to the amygdala and the hippocampus, the emotional memory centers. There's no thalamic relay the way there is for vision or hearing. Smell goes straight to the limbic system. So when Alfonso says he can't stand this fragrance, that's not a detached aesthetic judgment. His brain is literally routing that chemical signal into his emotional processing hardware before he's even consciously identified what he's smelling.
The smell is bypassing the bouncer and walking straight into the emotional nightclub.
That's exactly what's happening. And because of that direct connection, the emotional reaction, irritation, maybe even a little anxiety, can actually interfere with the habituation process. Negative affect slows olfactory adaptation. There's a study from 2012, Smeets and Dalton, that showed people who were told an odor was harmful habituated more slowly than people told the same odor was benign. The cognitive framing matters.
Wait, that's wild. The same molecule, same concentration. But if you think it's bad for you, your nose stays on high alert?
And the reverse is true too. If you associate a smell with something positive, you habituate faster. So Alfonso's situation has a bit of a vicious cycle built in. He hates the smell, which makes his brain tag it as aversive, which keeps his attention on it, which slows habituation, which gives him more time to hate it.
The practical question becomes, can he break that cycle? Short of, you know, taping an air purifier to his face.
There are actually several things he can do, and I want to walk through them because some are more effective than most people realize. The first and most straightforward is to introduce a competing odor that he does like. This isn't about masking. Masking with another strong fragrance often makes things worse because you just get a more complex bad smell. It's about providing an alternative attentional target.
A small, pleasant scent source in his own office. Something he controls.
A desktop diffuser with a scent he enjoys, maybe something subtle, cedar, citrus, whatever works for him. What this does is it gives his olfactory system something to latch onto that isn't the building fragrance. Over time, the building scent becomes the background, and his chosen scent becomes the foreground. It's a form of attentional redirect.
That's clever because it doesn't try to fight the building system. It just gives his nose somewhere else to be.
And the science backs this up. Our olfactory system is designed to detect change and novelty. A constant background odor rapidly becomes invisible to conscious perception. But if all you have is one aversive constant odor, your attentional system keeps getting pulled back to it because there's nothing else competing for that sensory channel. Adding a pleasant alternative gives your brain permission to ignore the background.
What about the more aggressive approach? Air purifiers with activated carbon filters, that kind of thing.
Definitely worth doing, especially for a private office. A good HEPA unit with a substantial carbon pre-filter can reduce volatile organic compounds, which is what most artificial fragrances are, by a meaningful amount. Not 100%, but enough to take the edge off. The carbon absorbs the odor molecules. The key thing is that the filter has to have enough carbon mass. Those little desktop units with a thin carbon sheet do almost nothing. You want something with at least a few pounds of activated carbon.
The filter needs to actually have some heft to it, not the decorative version.
The decorative ones are basically white noise machines with a blue light. The other thing Alfonso can try, and this one is more direct, is to talk to the building management about the fragrance system itself.
I was wondering when we'd get to that. The elephant in the scented room.
Here's the thing. Many commercial buildings use these fragrance systems as part of what's called sensory branding or ambient scenting. It's a whole industry. The idea is that a signature scent makes the building feel more premium, more memorable. But these systems are almost always adjustable. The diffusers have settings for intensity, duty cycle, how often they pulse the fragrance, and sometimes even which fragrance cartridge is installed.
He's not necessarily stuck with this exact concentration forever.
And building managers are often surprisingly receptive to this feedback, because they don't want tenants leaving over something as fixable as a scent setting. they may have just set it to whatever the vendor recommended and never thought about it again. Alfonso can frame it as, "Look, I love the space, I want to be here, but the fragrance intensity in my office is making it hard for me to work. Can we dial it back or adjust the schedule?"
That last part, the schedule, seems important. If the fragrance system isn't running 24/7, maybe there are windows where it's off or lower.
Many commercial systems run on a timer tied to business hours. Knowing the schedule means Alfonso can at least understand the rhythm of it. He might even find that mornings are worse because the system kicks on after being off all night, and by afternoon it's less noticeable. Knowing that pattern can help psychologically even if it doesn't change the exposure.
There's something else I want to circle back to. You mentioned that negative framing slows habituation. Is there a version of cognitive reappraisal that actually works here? Can Alfonso talk himself into hating it less?
The evidence on this is mixed but cautiously optimistic. Pure cognitive reappraisal, just telling yourself, "This smell is fine actually," doesn't do much on its own, but when it's paired with a concrete behavioral shift, it seems to help. For example, if Alfonso can reframe the smell as a neutral signal rather than an intrusion, "This is just the building's HVAC doing its thing. It's not directed at me. It's not a threat." That can reduce the limbic activation. Combine that with the pleasant diffuser in his own space, and you've got a dual approach. The brain gets the cognitive message and the sensory alternative.
It's basically giving your amygdala a job reassignment. You're not on threat detection anymore. Here, smell this cedar.
That's exactly the metaphor, and the amygdala is very suggestible in this regard. It takes its cues from context and behavior. If you act like something isn't a problem, by not tensing up when you notice the smell, by redirecting your attention, the emotional response diminishes over time.
Let me ask the question Alfonso might be wondering, but didn't say directly. Is there a point where this doesn't work? Where someone is sensitive enough that habituation never fully arrives, and the only real solution is to leave?
Yes, and I want to be honest about that. There's a condition called multiple chemical sensitivity, or idiopathic environmental intolerance, where people develop severe reactions to low-level chemical exposures, including fragrances. It's controversial in some medical circles, but the lived experience of people who have it is very real. Symptoms can include headaches, respiratory issues, cognitive fog. For someone with MCS, habituation doesn't really happen in the normal way because the exposure is dysregulating their system each time.
We're not saying Alfonso has that, but the spectrum exists.
And even short of a clinical condition, some people just have a fragrance sensitivity that doesn't fully adapt. If after 2 or 3 months, with all the interventions we've discussed, he's still miserable every time he walks in, then yeah, the cost-benefit calculation shifts. But that's the endpoint. Most people, even highly sensitive ones, will see substantial improvement within 4 to 8 weeks if they're actively managing it.
Let's talk about why this is harder than it sounds from the outside. Because I think most people hear you'll get used to the smell, and imagine it's like getting used to a new air freshener in your car. But an office is different. It's where you work. It's where you need to focus. A constant aversive stimulus in your productivity environment is draining.
There's a concept in environmental psychology called cognitive load from sensory stress. When part of your attentional budget is constantly being spent on suppressing or managing a sensory irritant, you have less cognitive capacity available for everything else. Decision-making gets worse. Creative thinking narrows. It's not trivial.
Alfonso isn't just being fussy. He's protecting his ability to do his actual job. He's a music producer. His ears are his primary tool, but his cognitive clarity is the whole operation.
For a music producer specifically, there's an interesting crossover here. The olfactory and auditory systems don't directly interfere with each other at the sensory level. They're different modalities. But at the attentional and emotional level, they absolutely compete. If his brain is spending resources processing an aversive smell, that's resources not available for critical listening, for creative decision-making, for the kind of nuanced auditory attention that music production demands.
This is the part where I admit something. I have a theory about artificial fragrances in commercial spaces, and it's probably unfair, but I'm going to say it anyway.
I'm braced.
I think they're the olfactory equivalent of corporate stock photography. They're designed to be inoffensive to everyone and end up being pleasing to no one. They're the Muzak of smells, the beige wallpaper of the nose.
There's actually some truth to that, and it's not just a matter of taste. The fragrance industry designs commercial scenting products to hit a very narrow band of broad acceptability. They use what are called white fragrance profiles, balanced, neutral, non-polarizing. The problem is that in trying to offend no one, they create something that has no character. It's not a smell you'd ever choose to have in your home. It's the olfactory equivalent of a default ringtone.
The Glockenspiel of corporate approachability.
I'm going to let that one stand on its own. And because it's characterless, it's also harder to form a positive association with. It doesn't smell like anything real. It doesn't connect to memory or place. It's just scent as a placeholder for professional environment.
Which brings us back to Alfonso's private office solution. If he can put something in there that does smell real, something with character, he's not just masking, he's reclaiming the space.
Reclaiming is exactly the right framing. This is about agency. One of the things that makes an aversive environmental stimulus so stressful is the lack of control. When you can't escape it and you didn't choose it, the stress response is amplified. Giving himself a scent he chose in a space he controls reverses that dynamic. Even if the building fragrance is still present in the background, his brain knows there's a chosen alternative available. That knowledge alone reduces the threat signaling.
The psychological intervention and the sensory intervention are doing the same work from different angles. They're both saying, you're not trapped in this smell.
And I want to add one more practical tip that most people don't consider.
The perfume counter trick.
Yes, but there's actual science behind it. Coffee contains compounds that act as a mild olfactory palate cleanser. Perfumers and sommeliers use coffee beans between samples because the volatile compounds in coffee temporarily desensitize your olfactory receptors to the previous scent. It's not a permanent fix, but keeping a small jar of coffee beans on the desk and giving it a quick sniff when the building fragrance feels overwhelming can provide momentary relief. It's like a reset button for your nose.
A nasal CTRLZ.
I hate how much I like that description. The effect only lasts a few minutes, but sometimes that's enough to break the attentional lock. You notice the bad smell, you give it a moment of attention, then you sniff the coffee and move on. It prevents the spiral.
Let's talk about the log arc here. Alfonso signed for a year. He's going to implement some of this. Let's say he gets a good carbon filter, puts a diffuser with a scent he likes in his office, talks to building management about the intensity, keeps some coffee beans around. What does week one look like versus week eight?
Week one is going to be rough regardless. Even with all the interventions, the novelty of the smell is high, the emotional reaction is fresh, and the habituation process is just getting started. He'll probably notice it constantly, feel frustrated, and wonder if he made a mistake. That's normal, and it doesn't mean the plan isn't working. By week three or four, he should start noticing that there are stretches of time, maybe an hour or two, where he realizes he hasn't thought about the smell. Those gaps get longer. By week 8, for most people, the building fragrance has faded into the background. It's still there if he deliberately pays attention to it, but it's no longer intruding on his conscious awareness.
If it's still intrusive at week 8?
Then we escalate. At that point, he's given habituation a fair shot with active management, and it's reasonable to have a more direct conversation with building management about alternatives. Could they switch to a different fragrance? Could they disable the diffuser in his office entirely? Could they install a separate zone control? Most managed buildings have more flexibility than they initially let on. The default setting isn't set in stone.
There's also the nuclear option, which is to identify exactly which fragrance compound is being used, and then specifically desensitize to it through controlled exposure. Is that even a thing?
It is a thing, but I wouldn't recommend it as a DIY project. Allergists and some occupational health specialists do use controlled exposure protocols for certain types of chemical sensitivity. But it's medical, it's supervised, and it's usually reserved for cases where avoidance isn't possible and the sensitivity is causing significant functional impairment. For an office fragrance situation, it's almost certainly overkill. The behavioral and environmental interventions we've discussed should handle it.
I want to zoom out for a second and ask the bigger question. Why are we pumping artificial fragrance into commercial buildings at all? Where did this come from?
The modern commercial scenting industry really took off in the late 90s and early 2000s. It grew out of the convergence of two things, advances in HVAC integrated diffusion technology, and the rise of sensory marketing as a discipline. There was a landmark study in the early 90s that showed shoppers in a scented environment rated products more favorably and spent more time browsing. The retail sector jumped on it. Then hotels started using signature scents as part of brand identity, and from there it leaked into premium office buildings as a way to signal, this is a high-end space.
The Westin Hotel White Tea thing.
Westin was one of the pioneers. They introduced their white tea scent in the mid-2000s, and it became a case study in sensory branding. Other chains followed. Now it's so normalized that people expect a certain kind of building to smell a certain way. The absence of scent reads as absence of amenity.
Which is wild when you think about it. We've trained ourselves to associate chemical fragrance with luxury. The cleaner and more expensive the space, the more it smells like something that doesn't exist in nature.
That's the tension Alfonso was living in. He chose a premium managed building. The fragrance is part of that premium package. It's not a bug in the building's design, it's a feature. It's just a feature that happens to be driving him up the wall.
The feature bug distinction is entirely about who's experiencing it. For the building manager, it's ambiance. For Alfonso, it's a low-grade chemical assault he didn't consent to.
Consent is actually a useful lens here. One of the reasons artificial fragrances in shared spaces are so polarizing is that they're an ambient imposition. You can't opt out. With noise, you can wear headphones. With light, you can close blinds or wear sunglasses. But smell is harder to block. You have to breathe. So when a building saturates the air with a fragrance, it's making a choice for everyone in that space, and there's no easy individual off switch.
Except the carbon filter and the coffee beans and the pleasant diffuser, which are all just workarounds for a choice someone else made.
And that's why I think the conversation with building management is actually the most important intervention on the list. Not because it's guaranteed to work, but because it restores the sense of agency. Alfonso is saying, I'm a tenant here, I'm paying for this space, and I have a legitimate concern about the environment I'm working in. That's not being difficult. That's being a reasonable occupant of a shared commercial space.
Not your building stinks, but I have a sensitivity, and I'd love to find a solution that works for everyone.
Building managers deal with complaints all day. A tenant who comes in collaborative and solution-oriented is a breath of fresh air, so to speak. They're much more likely to make adjustments for someone who's working with them than for someone who's just angry.
I want to hit one more angle before we wrap. You mentioned volatile organic compounds earlier. Are there actual health concerns with these commercial fragrances, or is that mostly alarmism?
It depends on the specific formulation and the concentration. Most commercial fragrance systems use synthetic compounds that are generally recognized as safe at the concentrations used. But generally recognized as safe doesn't mean zero effect. Some people experience respiratory irritation, headaches, or exacerbation of existing conditions like asthma. The research on long-term low-level exposure is still evolving, and there's legitimate debate about whether current safety standards adequately account for sensitive populations.
It's not that the building is poisoning him, but it's also not nothing.
For the vast majority of people, the exposure from a commercial scenting system isn't going to cause measurable health harm. But for a subset, people with asthma, migraines, chemical sensitivities, it can be a genuine health issue, not just an annoyance. And the fragrance industry has historically been pretty resistant to transparency about what's actually in their formulations, which doesn't help.
Trade secrets versus public health. The classic tension.
And fragrance formulations are protected as trade secrets, which means there's no requirement to disclose the full ingredient list. You might see fragrance on a label or a safety data sheet, and that single word can represent dozens or even hundreds of individual compounds. For someone trying to figure out what they're reacting to, it's a black box.
That seems relevant for Alfonso. If he does end up talking to building management, one of the things he could ask is what specific fragrance product they're using, and whether the manufacturer provides any detail about the formulation. Even just knowing the brand and product name gives him something to research.
And if the building manager doesn't know, which is common because these systems are often installed and maintained by a third-party vendor, Alfonso can ask for the vendor's contact information. It's a reasonable request from a tenant who's experiencing a reaction.
All right, let's pull this together. For Alfonso, and for anyone else stuck in a scented environment they didn't choose, the adaptation path is real. Olfactory habituation happens at the receptor level and the brain level. It takes weeks, not days, and it's slower for highly sensitive people, but it does happen. In the meantime, there are concrete things to do. carbon filtration, a pleasant personal diffuser, coffee beans, talking to management about intensity and scheduling, and the psychological piece matters as much as the physical. Reframing the smell as neutral background noise, reclaiming agency over your own space, not spiraling into, I made a terrible mistake.
That's a perfect summary. The only thing I'd add is, give it time, but not infinite time. Set a mental checkpoint. If you're still miserable at the 8-week mark after trying the interventions, that's useful information. It tells you this particular environment and your particular sensory system may not be compatible, and that's okay. It doesn't mean you failed at adapting. It means you learned something about what you need in a workspace.
That knowledge is worth the effort of finding out.
Korn. Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1980s, a Hanseatic League historian calculated that the medieval league's standard barrel for herring trade, the Rostock-ton, held approximately 1.4 name-of-desert ostrich eggs per liter of brine displacement, which means a fully loaded cog ship carried the egg-equivalent volume of roughly 12,000 adult ostriches.
I have so many questions, and I'm choosing to ask none of them.
The Namib Desert ostrich egg as a unit of maritime commerce is not something I had on my bingo card. Thank you, Hilbert.
To close out, Alfonso, thank you for sending this in. It's a practical question that touches on neuroscience, workplace design, and the quiet stress of sensory environments we didn't choose. For everyone listening, if you're in a scented space you hate, you're not being dramatic. Your nose is doing exactly what it evolved to do. It just needs a little help standing down.
If you've got a weird prompt of your own, send it to us. We love these. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.